KJZZ's original production, The Show, is supported by Banner Health, Arizona's largest nonprofit healthcare system. Last year, Banner reinvested more than $1.1 billion in community health and charity care. Banner Health, nonprofit for Arizona. BannerHealth.com/nonprofit4AZ.
Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, new rules from the Trump administration could cause problems for international students at American universities. And we'll have the latest installment of our summer soapbox essay series on road trips. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I know better than anyone that this campaign is not going to be easy. I've been underestimated in every single race that I've ever run. But I will tell you this, I have never lost.
Katie Hobbs hasn't really delivered for Latinos either. And so I believe that Donald Trump has delivered more for Latinos than Katie, and I believe I will deliver more as governor.
Why did I decide to run for office? It is a desire to leave this country better for our children and our grandchildren. That's it in its core. You know, what we're doing is fighting for the future of this country. I truly believe that.
He said that he is going to follow orders from one man, the guy in the White House. And, you know, I don't think that's what the voters of the Arizona 1st District really want to see here.
We will fight crime. We will defend the laws and the Constitution, and we will root out every single bit of fraud, waste, and corruption in this state.
The misleadingly titled Protect Education Accountability Now Act is a shameless attack on Arizona's parents funded by an out-of-state union. We don't believe the unions have turned in enough ballot signatures and that they're trying to game the system to get on the ballot. That's why we filed this challenge.
And with me to break down the results of this week's primaries and look ahead to November are Jaime Molera with the firm Molera Alvarez. Jaime, good morning.
Good morning.
And Gael Esposito of Creosote Partners. Gael, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, too.
Jaime, let me start with you. Who had the best night, Tuesday night? Or I guess maybe even, you know, leaking into Wednesday morning?
Well, that's a good question. I would say Feely campaign. I think they were a bit anxious because Chaplick was really making some progress at the end.
In the first congressional district.
In CD1, correct. And so they were able to leverage a lot of the Turning Point support. And most of the Turning Point candidates, and I should say Turning Point actually had a pretty good night because mm-hmm. most of their candidates did pretty well.
Kyle, who do you think had the best night?
The Democratic Party. I think seeing some of these Republican winners, I'm feeling pretty good about their chances in November.
Okay, so which ones, like if you are, which campaigns this week are maybe feeling perhaps more confident than they were maybe Sunday or Monday?
I think, you know, if I'm Adrian Fontes, I was probably a little bit more nervous about Gina Swoboda winning that primary and getting to go up against Alex Colladan is something that, you know, he's probably very excited about. I think the governor is in a really great position. Andy Biggs is an extreme candidate who is going to follow Trump and Turning Point wherever they point and tell him to go. So I think she's in a really strong position. I think we are looking at a big Democratic wave here this time.
Do you agree with that, Jaime?
No.
Do you think that the Republican candidates as problematic as Democrats think they might be?
And I'm not stumping for the GOP. I mean, I just think Arizona's are still a conservative Republican state. And while I would agree that the governor has a good chance of winning, juxtaposed against Andy Biggs, because Andy Biggs is close to President Trump, whose numbers are not very good in Arizona right now, but you still have 330,000 more Republicans. And so the Republican Party, particularly Biggs, has to message the campaign in a way that really affects Arizonans and gets Republicans to come out for him. I still think that it's going to be a very tight race. We heard earlier where Governor Hobbs said that she's been underestimated a lot. Well, Andy Biggs has been also. I remember when he became Senate president, A lot of people didn't think he'd be able to get that when he ran for Congress the first time. A lot of people didn't think he'd be able to win there. So I think it's going to be a good race. You have two seasoned politicians, and it's there's going to be a lot of money thrown into this.
Yeah. Well, and we've already seen TV ads like the next day. Both right. Hobbs and Biggs' campaign had TV ads. Do you think it's safe to say, Jaime, that from the Hobbs campaign, we're just going to continue to see Andy Biggs linked to Donald Trump and, to an extent, Jeffrey Epstein?
Absolutely. I mean, you're going to see that up until Election Day. I mean, they're really going to be pounding that. I think, conversely, the Biggs campaign is going to be talking about the ineffectiveness of her administration really to move anything. I think you're going to see a lot of attention be paid to the vetoes, ironically enough, because they're going to say, well, she really hasn't done anything as governor. Mm. All she was able to do is block things. So it's going to be interesting how they message that and what are the things that will break through in order to convince, again, Republicans to come out and vote, because that's going to be the key for the Biggs campaign.
So, Gail, if you're the Hobbs campaign, how do you try to take her record and say to voters, make it for something, I guess, as opposed to just, hey, I'm here blocking all this stuff that the Republicans in the legislature are trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, the governor has a clear record of getting bipartisan budgets passed pretty effectively with her priorities in them. I think we saw this year the moratorium on data center tax credits. That's going to be a big thing that they'll talk about in the immediate. They've signed some really interesting and good housing affordability laws to cut red tape. I think they're going to focus on that sort of record.
And Jaime, we've seen Andy Biggs talk about, you know, working with Democrats. I mean, he said, you know, he worked with Kyrsten Sinema. He worked with Hakeem Jeffries. I think he maybe name dropped John McCain also at one point, maybe forgetting McCain was actually a Republican.
Right.
But I guess to what extent do you think Biggs is going to try to lean into that in the general election as opposed to his, you know, his ties to Donald Trump, his ties to Turning Point?
Well, and I've said this before, I think on the show, where if Andy Biggs becomes the person he was when he was Senate president, as opposed to the person he is as Congressman Biggs, that, you know, is head of the Freedom Caucus, that's been very tied to President Trump. If you look at his campaign, they really haven't been talking to Turning Point. They really haven't been talking about Donald Trump at all. And I think that's for a reason, right? So I think you're going to see them really start to move away from the ties to Trump and really focus on, you know, the message of their campaign, which is a better economy and a governor that's going to be more effective.
So one more question about this primary. Are you surprised at the margin and how badly David Schweikert lost?
I'm not. And the reason is because regardless of how effective they may be in the general, which I don't think they'll be as effective, but Turning Point in a Republican primary is absolutely critical. And I think when they threw his weight behind Andy Biggs, I think it had an impact. And I'm not so sure why. I think Karen Taylor Robeson saw that very early on. Mm. She dropped out of the campaign at the beginning of the year. I was kind of surprised that Schweikert stayed on to the bitter end. But I figure he figured that he was going to catch lightning in a bottle, but it just never happened.
Yeah. Gail, when do you expect to hear who the candidates might pick as their lieutenant governor running mates? The first time that we're going to have these, so there's kind of no precedent for this.
Yeah, I think they're going to wait a little bit here, you know, get a little separation from the primary news cycle when things are a little bit more quiet, try to get some attention out of those picks. But yeah, I think there's no precedent. There's a lot of way to make a splash about it, a lot of education that's going to have to happen with voters that this new position exists and why we're doing it. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of potential there for some good earned media cycles for both campaigns.
Do you think that it will matter? I mean, there's every 4 years there's talk about, you know, does the vice presidential pick move the needle or not? Do you think lieutenant governor moves the needle here?
No, not unless they pick somebody who ends up being a complete dud. I mean, that's really it. Unless that person does something extremely controversial or has scandal, I don't think it makes that much of a difference for folks.
What do you think, Amy?
Sarah Palin might be moving into Arizona.
I mean, she lived here for a while, right? I don't know that she still does, but she used to.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I think it depends on what the polls say, too. If the governor looks like she's pulling away from Congressman Biggs, then I would anticipate her waiting and saying, you know what, I'm going to pick somebody that's more closer to my political affiliation. But if it's really, really tight, then you might see her looking to get, you know, there's been a lot of rumblings about a McCain, Jimmy McCain,
yeah,
in the mix. Former mayor of Mesa, Mayor John Giles.
John Giles, yeah.
Giles being in the mix. So I think a lot of that might play into it.
Okay. Jaime, let me stick with you and ask about a couple other statewide races. Gael mentioned Alexander Culloden, state representative, won the primary for Secretary of State. If you're the Fontes campaign, is that what you're hoping for?
Yes. Short answer, yes. Absolutely.
Do you think that he starts the general as the favorite?
Fontes, absolutely. I think it's going to be very hard for Culloden with his record. He's just been very divisive within the Republican ranks. So that certainly gives Fontes an advantage.
Okay. And in the attorney general race, there's a competitive primary on the Republican side. Rodney Glassman and Warren Peterson, Senate President Peterson won that. How do you handicap the general election, you know, 3 days after the primary here?
That's going to be a very, very competitive race. I think Attorney General Mays is a good candidate. I mean, she's been around politics for a long time. Her weak spot is going to be her relationship with the business community. I mean, she's been very progressive in a lot of her outlook, especially towards business interests. A lot of business groups that were not happy with some of the things she's done. I think that might help Peterson, but it's still going to be a very tight race.
Do you think it's going to be I mean, she won, you know, if it's more than 300 votes for Mays this time, it's a landslide compared to her race, you know, 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chris Mays has been running an excellent campaign. She's been on TV. She has a great record and ability to get attention to her causes and has been seen fighting for the little guy, even in rural Arizona, where she's been really active in protecting water rights and standing up for community out there. I think that she recognized how small those votes, that vote margin was, and she's going everywhere in the state to pick them up. And I think she's running a really good race.
Do you think that of the two candidates, she got the one to face in November that she wanted?
I think I was feeling pretty good if I was her either way. I mean, Rodney Glassman is a perennial loser. So I think if he had won a race, that would have been the more surprising thing. But Warren Peterson is somebody who's fresh out of law school. Like he does not have that much experience as a lawyer. He's not somebody who like has done the job. And Chris Mays has a great record where she's been standing up against monopoly corporations, where she's been fighting to protect folks' water rights and the rights of consumers, protecting renters from price gouging and landlords who have been just seeking to scam people. I think she has a great record to run on, and I'm feeling pretty good if I'm her.
Okay, Jaime, one more race, an office you know well, the Superintendent of Public Instruction. This was another competitive primary, and the incumbent, Tom Horn, actually lost to Kimberly Yee, and a race that was, you know, not a blowout, but also not terribly close. Is this an example, do you think, of what you were saying earlier about Turning Point had a good night?
I think it absolutely has an impact, and it had an impact on that race because they came out and endorsed her. She was part of what was called their golden ticket, so she definitely benefited from that. But remember, Kimberly Yee also has a name of her own. I mean, she was the highest Republican vote getter in the last campaign statewide. So I think that makes her a known entity, and she, by and large, has done a very good job as a treasurer. So I think that really helped her for this race.
Is that race down ballot enough where, you know, anything that might be going on in terms of the feelings about President Trump or feelings about Turning Point, like it doesn't necessarily work its way down to superintendent?
I think so. I think so. I think a lot of the races, you know, below attorney general, really, you know, I know a lot of Democrats would like to say that's going to happen. But I just, again, going back to the factor that there's 330,000 more Republicans, it's going to be difficult in those types of races for a Republican not to lose, unless you're a really bad candidate, unless you really just have made a mess of your campaign or taken positions that are so extreme. Republicans should have a good opportunity to win these down-ticket seats.
Gael, how do Democrats try to maintain, to the extent that there is momentum at the top of the ballot, how do they try to keep that going down to a race like superintendent, like the legislature, some of those other races?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we saw in 2018 with Kathy Hoffman, the Democrats be successful in picking this up. I think, you know, Kimmy's a better candidate than Frank Riggs on this front. So it's going to be a little bit tougher for Teresa Leyva Ruiz. But she has been really hustling out there. doing the work. I think she has a great resume and, you know, has that experience as a teacher, as an administrator that folks will look to. But I do think with that level of down ballot, it is largely just a matter of how big of a year is it for Democrats? Mm. Or is it a little bit of a better year for Republicans than folks maybe are expecting? And I think those national trends really do impact that race more than maybe, as Hyman was saying, the top three.
Gaia, let's start with the first congressional district. This is sort of a Scottsdale, Fountain Hills, East Valley district. David Schweikert, longtime representative. He, of course, ran for governor, as we talked about. So there are competitive primaries on both sides. And the party's pick, the National Democrats' pick, did not win. It was Amish Shah who once again came out of this primary. What does that tell you?
I mean, I was shocked to see how late the DCCC started spending. It was a week after ballots had dropped. And you saw that start to impact the vote totals as the ballots were counted and the race narrowed slightly. But just too little, too late. And I credit to Amish Shah, he hustles. He knocks on doors. He has those deep conversations with voters. And he, you know, started off with an advantage in polling and name recognition. And I think he did what he had to do to really just secure that. He was in mailboxes early. He was out there in the field early, and he just ran a better campaign.
What does he have to do differently this time to not have the same result as 2 years ago when he lost to David Schweikert?
I think he does. You know, the door knocking is really successful in a crowded primary, and I think it is an important aspect of a general election campaign. But being able to go up on TV and compete on all the different media outlets out there is going to be critical. I think you're going to see a lot of national money pour in to help there. But his campaign's going to have to control that message a little bit. I think he is also just going to benefit from that better national environment than a couple of years ago and an open seat, right? He's running against a guy who was an NFL kicker and a color commentator. I mean, the thing he maybe is best known for is having an SNL sketch about how mediocre of a kicker he was. So, like, I don't know that he's the best candidate for Congress, but, you know, he is charismatic at the very least, but they both are.
All right, I think the NFL kicker, Jay Feely, of course.
I think it makes him 80% more competent than most of the people we have in Congress right now.
So, Jaime, what are your takeaways from that campaign, from the Republican? Well, Feely, of course, had the Trump endorsement,
right.
But Joseph Chaplick had a pretty deep ties with sort of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, right, and some of the, you know, right, you know, far right folks in, right, in that district.
Well, and money makes a difference. I mean, Feely was able to get the Turning Point support. He was able to get a lot of money early on, which I think made a big difference. It was a tight campaign. Chaplick ran a very strong campaign, I think, really tried to get to the right of Feely. So now Feely needs to really position himself away from, like we talked about with Governor, same thing. I mean, he really needs to say, look, I'm going to be my own person. I'm going to focus on these issues. I think Shah is going to just try and tie him to the hip with President Trump, and that's going to be the best chance that they have.
Is that maybe more important for Feely in that district, which is not traditionally anyway, not a super MAGA type district?
And I think Shah's the best candidate for Feely in a lot of ways, because there was a reason why the DCCC was pushing Marlene Garland Woods so hard, is that they saw the polling data that showed that, you know, Shah is a fairly progressive he was a fairly progressive legislator, and that's the position he's going to be in Congress. So they knew in that particular district, which is a very centrist district, it still leans Republican, he's going to have a tough time with his positions that he's taken in the past. So I think they see Feely as the best choice, and that's why I think if it would have been Chaplick, then I think that would have been maybe a difference. But Feely is certainly the best candidate for the Republicans.
Guy, one more question on this district for you. Is it going to be awkward? You'd mentioned national money coming in for Shah. Is it going to be awkward between the DCCC and him? Because they obviously endorsed one of his opponents, and he was not shy about saying he wasn't thrilled about it.
Yeah, I mean, he shouldn't have been, but I think there are no permanent enemies, no permanent friends, especially when you're on the same team here. I think Shah even cracked a joke about it at his victory party that hopefully he'll get their endorsement now. But like, I think they will bury the hatchet on this pretty quickly and work together to win this seat. And I think Shah had a record where, you know, he, for being in a solidly blue district as a legislator, he broke with the party pretty often. So I think he does have the profile for the district. I think, you know, his experience as a doctor is something that, like, will contrast nicely to football kicker.
When so, apparently yeah. they both were with the New York Jets at the same time.
That's right.
Shaw was one of the sideline physicians when Feeley was a kicker there. So kind of an interesting. I'm not sure either of them necessarily wants to bring up the Jets and their connection to them during this campaign. But
that's what hurt them.
That's a Giants fan talking. So take that for what it's worth. Jaime, one of the other, maybe the other competitive district in Arizona is CD6 in Tucson, where Juan Ciscomani is the incumbent. He did not have a competitive primary. Joanna Mendoza, the Democratic nominee. How do you see that? Obviously, we're still ways out, but how do you see that race shaping up at this moment?
Well, both of those districts, congressional districts 1 and 6, are going to be ground zero for the national fight to who controls Congress and who controls, in this case, the House of Representatives. So you're going to see a lot of money, more money than I think we've seen ever come into our state. Juan Ciscomani has a candidate that I think is going to be very good. I mean, she, former military, not seen as too progressive, even for being in that part of the state and down in Pima County. So Juan needs to really do a better job of positioning himself away again from the administration and showing that he's more centrist and it's going to be more fit for that district. But it's going to be a tough race. I think they're going to have a tough time holding on to it.
What do you think, Kyle?
I think Juan Ciscomani is toast, quite frankly. I think he is in a rough position. I think his polling shows it. I think being a down-the-line vote nearly 100% of the time for the Trump administration was a gamble he made to survive a primary challenge, and now it's going to hurt him in that general. And I think Joanna Mendoza is an absolutely stellar candidate who I think is going to flip that seat.
All right. Jaime, one more congressional question. In CD5, this is Andy Biggs' district that he, of course, left to run for governor. Former Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb. This is a very, very conservative district. Mark Lamb had, let's say, some baggage going into the primary. Still won handily.
Couple of stories, right?
Few things that were maybe a little unsavory. He, of course, is denying it. We should say he is saying that it's not true. But he still won pretty handily in that race. Is there any reason at all for him to be concerned in a general election, given all the stuff swirling around?
I don't think so. I think just the advantage of that district. Now,
the registration advantage.
The registration advantage is massive. Now, I think he needs to get some good attorneys because the moment he gets into Congress, you know, there's going to be some investigations going on. And so that's where they need to make sure that they're have all his facts straightened out.
Gail, is there any reason to think that National Democrats might spend a penny in that district?
No, I wouldn't if I were them. It's so far to the right. And I think, you know, once the congressional investigations start, maybe then, like, you start to uncover a little bit more and you have the opportunity for more stories that do enough there to where you have sort of an Alabama in 2017 or whenever that was situation where Democrats flipped a super red seat. But I think that he is pretty well positioned right now.
Okay. So we have about a minute left. I want to ask each of you, what was your biggest surprise based on the primary results? Kyle, I'll start with you.
I don't know if it was a surprise, but it was a really good night at the legislative level for progressives in the Democratic caucus. I think you saw them win a lot of open seats, flip some incumbents, you know, taking out Lydia Hernandez in LD24 by pretty large margins. You know, there's still an undecided one down in Pima County for the state Senate seat between Alma Hernandez and Rocky Perez that, like, could be another big pickup for progressive Democrats. So I think you saw a continuation of the shift we've been seeing nationally, which is people want fighters out there. People want folks who are willing to take on what we've been seeing from the Trump administration and fight for their priorities at every level. And so hopefully we'll continue to see that at the legislature.
All right. Jaime, what was your biggest surprise?
I guess we talked about it earlier. The only slight surprise was the margin of victory that Andy Biggs had over Schweikert. I think that bodes well for his campaign because you just don't get those votes. I mean, you really have to work it. You have to have a good organization. I know the Biggs campaign does have a good organization, and I think they're going to be formidable come November.
All right. Jaime Molera, Gael Esposito, thanks to you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up in the next installment of our summer soapbox series, a road trip home with a life-changing revelation. But first, the Trump administration is implementing new rules for international students at American colleges and universities. Under these new rules, those students will generally be limited to staying in this country for 4 years unless they get an extension. Students have previously been allowed to stay until they finish their programs. Supporters of the change say it'll cut down on the number of international students who come to the country for school and don't leave. Critics, meanwhile, argue many students need more than 4 years to finish their degrees, especially postgraduate ones. With me now to talk more about this is Joanna Alonzo, admissions and enrollment reporter with Inside Higher Ed. Joanna, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is the thinking behind this? Why is the administration trying to implement these?
Well, you basically nailed it on the head in the intro. There is this, the way that they described it is that they're worried about overstays. So students who remain in the country longer than they should, or who continue to take classes as a means of staying in the country longer. And they did provide some data in this regulation that says that there are about, I think they said 2,000 or 2,100 students who entered the country on an F-1 visa between 2000 and 2010 and are still here.
I mean, that it doesn't seem like a whole lot when you look at the universe of college students in this country.
No, I do think that the number is relatively small. And then also that 2000 to 2010 range is pretty big. So we don't know if those students have been here for 26 years or 16 years.
Okay. So I mentioned that there is the possibility of getting an extension. Is there a sense of like what that process will look like or how easy or difficult it might be for a student? Let's say they come for undergrad and want to stay for grad school, like how easy it might be to get an extension?
That is a really good question. So in the rule itself, it is, discretionary, but they did sort of say, we know people are really worried about this. This won't be hard for students that have legitimate reasons to need to stay beyond 4 years. So we're not 100% sure what that's going to look like. It's going to be a while till this starts happening, until we know what it's going to look like. The fear from some students and some international education professionals is that the government doesn't always understand nuances of higher ed, of, you know, very specific programs or research that might require students to stay longer. And there are some fears that the government and USCIS will look at something that is very academically legitimate, but they might not understand the nuances of it, and that could cause some issues.
Hmm. What are universities saying about this? I mean, especially, you know, big public universities like here in Arizona, like they really kind of rely on international students paying out of country tuition to, you know, to bring in a good amount of money.
Yes, that is absolutely true. International students, a lot of them pay full tuition, and a lot of schools do rely on that tuition. And on top of that, there is this question of the workload for the institutions. A lot of worry that they're going to have to hire more staff just to sort of facilitate these extension requests, and that could be very costly as well. So it's not even just about the tuition.
Well, it's interesting. So it might not just be on the students to do it. Maybe a selling point for a university could be, hey, if you need an extension, we will help you with that.
I think a lot of institutions would be planning to do that. Most institutions that have a significant number of international students have staff members that help with different parts of the visa process. Ultimately, I think most schools, both because, yeah, they do get that international student tuition, and that can be very beneficial. But I think if you're admitted to a school, most schools are interested in helping you succeed there. They don't want you to leave after 4 years with an incomplete degree. I think in most cases, schools are definitely planning to help with that part of the process.
Sure. How do the rules in this country compare to American students or other foreign students going to other foreign countries, and how long they're allowed to be there, and what the status is there?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I will say this is not my absolute area of expertise, but sure. I will say my understanding is that in a lot of countries, there are some limits to initially how long your visa lasts when you're studying internationally. In a lot of countries, it is not this blanket four-year policy. It is more that if you enter and you're going to be doing XYZ degree and the institution says, yeah, this is a five-year degree, your visa will be 5 years. So the US, the duration of status rule that allowed students to stay until they were done actually was fairly unique in its flexibility. It's coming a little bit more towards what some other countries have, but there are still distinctions between this new four-year policy and what is common elsewhere.
Hmm. So this is obviously not the first time the Trump administration has tried to enact or enacted a policy related to international students. I'm curious what you're hearing from universities and maybe what you're hearing from other professionals in this space in terms of what the overall impact has been and sort of where this rule might fit into that.
Yeah, so all of last year we had quite a few troubling things for international students, including folks might remember when students' CVIS statuses were terminated. Mm-hmm. CVIS is the online database that tracks international students. That was a big ordeal. There was a freeze on F-1 visa interviews early in the summer of 2025 that led to some big delays and students having problems getting those interviews. So there was a lot of anticipation that international student numbers would decline, and they did. There were a few different sources that showed declines in international students, declines in new international student visas, which is a pretty good indicator. This is something that's sometimes sort of hard to measure, and we're getting different numbers from different sources, but I do think that decline in new F-1 visas was a pretty good tell. So I think that those worries are coming true. And this could be, you know, it's all these factors coming together. It's both like, if you can't get a visa interview, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think there's also the fear of something going awry while you're here. And as the US, one of the biggest draws for students was, you know, this flexibility. Duration of status is really, really attractive. OPT, which is the system that allows students to work after, international students to work after they graduate, that is still, it still exists, but it's something that the Trump administration has indicated they might not be a huge fan of. And that's another huge selling point. So I think students are just more saying, like, the things that we really thought were cool about going to the US to study, like, we're not 100% sure that they're as strong as they once were.
Sure. Interesting. All right. That is Joanna Alonzo, admissions and enrollment reporter with Inside Higher Ed. Joanna, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you as well.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Saloons are certainly a staple of the American West. From gunslinging cowboys to hard-drinking outlaws to hard-scrabble sheriffs, when you think of the Wild West, you most likely think of saloons. Homer Teal documented hundreds of the saloons that crowded Tucson streets in the late 1800s. He even dug one of them up. Teal is an archaeologist and author of the book Saloons of Tucson, Arizona Territory, a 337-page chronicle of the rich history of Tucson saloons. Earlier this year, my co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him about the characters, drinks, and the inspiration for the book, an excavation of the Cactus Saloon on historic Block 83 in downtown Tucson.
You'd be surprised what is preserved under buildings and asphalt parking lots in both Tucson and in Phoenix. Once you strip off the building foundations and the parking lots, you're going to find the remnants of both historic period stuff and also the pre-contact Native American villages are waiting to be found.
So when did you start to realize what you were discovering under there was saloons?
Well, so prior to even starting the project, we look at Sanborn fire insurance maps, which are maps created by fire insurance companies so that adjusters in New York City can know what buildings are to be insured in downtown Tucson. And these maps in Tucson start in 1886 and go up into the 1950s. And so you look at those and you can see which buildings are there, and they'll say saloon on them. And then you look at city directories or newspapers and you can identify what they are. Like in this case, it was the Cactus Saloon.
Okay, tell us about the Cactus Saloon. When you started digging under the city for this particular spot, what'd you find?
So we targeted the backyard areas of the buildings on this particular project because that's where you find the outhouse pits and the wells.
Wow.
And prior to running water, people had outdoor bathrooms, and they would use them for maybe 5 or 10 years, and then they would pick up the building and move it, and then they'd use the old outhouse pit as a trash dump.
Huh.
And so we excavated an outhouse from the Cactus Saloon. We dig down in one foot levels, collect the artifacts, do another level. We take soil samples to get the plant remains. We collect all the animal bones. And we found a large amount of artifacts.
Like what?
Well, we found various types of alcoholic beverage bottles, whiskey and gin and champagne and wine. Hmm. We found soda bottles. We found many shoe polish bottles. So there was a shoe shine stand inside the saloon. We found fragments of an Anheuser-Busch mirror that once hung up behind the bar. And one of the cool things we found was pieces of the front window with words painted on them. We had the letters NY for New York. Mm-hmm. That was probably advertising a type of beer. And we had the letters FOO for food. And one of the things that people don't know about old-time saloons is they offered a free lunch if you bought a beer. And in this case, the Cactus Saloon, you'd get a sardine or a cheese or a ham sandwich once you bought a beer.
Once you bought a beer, you get your ham sandwich with it. That's awesome. I mean, so what intrigued you about this idea of old saloons in Tucson? Was it this excavation and finding these old things? Or did you start to realize this was a broader picture? There were a lot of these around back then.
So this started out as an archaeology project. I did some research in the other saloons, and this project took place in 2005, and that meant, you know, reading through reels of microfilm.
Right.
But in the years since then, all the newspapers have been scanned in and are available online. And so you could search the word saloon and find articles about saloons. And during COVID, when I didn't have anything else to do, I decided to research every saloon in Tucson and found information on over 300 of them.
300 of them. My goodness. So this was quite a saloon town, it sounds like.
Yes. At one time, there were at least 34 separate saloons for a town of less than 10,000 people.
My goodness. I mean, I have to say, it does sort of play into the idea of what a town like Tucson might have been like back then, like this idea of the Wild West. Is that what you found when you started researching these places, that it was gunfights and raucous drinking that we might assume based on old movies?
That is exactly the opposite of what happened.
Huh.
So in the territorial period, I searched from 1860 to 1914, and during that 54-year period, there were 8 murders associated with saloons. Saloons really served a purpose for all the many single men in Tucson who didn't have any other entertainment venues. And so going to a saloon and having a drink, playing a game of cards, that was a fun activity to do. I mean, there was eventually an opera house, and eventually they had movie theaters, but there wasn't much else to do.
Hmm. So it was a kind of a community center almost.
Yes. And each of them was different. So if you wanted to go to the Mexican saloons down on Meyer Street, you could go there, or you could go to the ones that had restaurants associated with them and have a meal and have a drink. A lot of them had gambling games of various types.
Mm-hmm.
They also had music, but eventually the city of Tucson decided to start cleaning up things, and eventually music was banned from being in saloons.
Music, of all things, not the gambling?
Oh, guess what? Gambling was also banned.
Ah, there you go. I mean, so tell us about some of your favorite tidbits, maybe characters that you've uncovered in this. Like, there are owners and people, a lot of immigrants who came in and started saloons in Tucson, it sounds like.
Yes. So there were a lot of Italian, Austrian, French, and German saloon owners, or at least employees. There was a guy named Mr. Barlogi who was from Italy, and he had a machine where you crank the handle and looked in this opening, and you could watch sort of an old-fashioned movie. Hmm. Well, somebody reported them, and the sheriff came and looked at that movie, and it was horrified that it was a dirty movie. So he took the machine into the sheriff's office and went up and reported it to the mayor and city council. And they all trooped down to the sheriff's office and they all cranked the handle to watch this movie and were just horrified by it. And so they called in Mr. Barlogi and he said, I didn't know this was a bad thing, you know. And then they took his license for operating a saloon away.
Over a bad movie, huh?
Yes. And of course, I'm really curious, what was it?
What was in the movie? Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to tell me, because 337 saloons you've kind of uncovered here and documented in this book, and you've spent a lot of time learning about these places and documenting them. If you had to pick one that you could go back in time and go to, what would it be?
I would go to, well, there'd be two. I'd want to go to the Cactus Saloon mm-hmm. because I dug it up. And then there was the Congress Hall Saloon. And that one started in May of 1868. And that was the fancy saloon. And the surviving photographs of the interior show just how beautiful it was. And they had a cabinet of minerals and an elk head. Hmm. And, you know, it was an interesting place.
All right. Well, you've given us quite a history lesson. That is Homer Teal, an archaeologist and author of Saloons of Tucson, Arizona Territory. Homer, thank you for coming on. Thanks for telling us so much about this. It's fascinating stuff.
You're welcome.
And now here's the latest essay in our summer soapbox series on the topic of road trips. For Phoenix writer and graduate student Amanda Kerberg, one particular drive across the country wasn't just a road trip. It was the beginning of a journey.
My dad and I were about 30 minutes outside Albuquerque when I realized I'd forgotten my favorite pillow. It was back at the hotel, camouflaged in a crisp white case. It was a Goldilocks pillow, down feathers, just the right amount of give and pushback. Like a good parent. We decided not to go back. I could get another pillow. I was on my way back from graduate school in Oklahoma for the summer. We'd already taken a few detours, stood on the grassy knoll in Dallas, snapped selfies with George W. Bush's rather lumpy early portraiture at the Presidential Library, and cheered on the Oklahoma City Thunder in the playoffs. In Albuquerque, we stopped by the Candy Lady, and my dad posed as Walter White from Breaking Bad with a box full of bright blue rock candy designed after the show's iconic meth. His arm started to shake under the weight, little tremors, like at dinner the night before. I kicked my shoes off and stretched my feet out on the dash. "Tell me about Tiger," I said, while I got to work building Ritz cracker sandwiches of cheddar cheese and summer sausage. Tiger was a little mutt puppy born on the U.S. Naval Base in Keflavik, Iceland, where my dad was stationed for a year in the 1970s, working on aircraft equipment in a massive hangar while nearby stations scanned the oceans for possible Soviet activity. My dad's Navy stories were always my favorite road trip entertainment, a classic Bildungsroman, but with more comedy. He'd joined the Navy to avoid the Vietnam draft and spent his first 3 years on an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. He told of day trips to Pompeii, playing Don't Look with his bunkmates, the time the jet blast picked him up and threw him across the deck like a leaf. But the best stories were of Tiger, how he would jump into your arms when you patted your chest, the time they were driving around the base in a freezing Iceland winter in a U.S. Navy-issued open-top Jeep, and Tiger was yeeted out of the side on a sharp turn. Tiger always landed on his feet. He once chased down a taxiing aircraft, just a tiny brown and gold fluffball barking and yelping at a gigantic plane, followed by my dad waving his arms to stop. And then Tiger just bounded over to the plane's front wheel, lifted his leg, and peed. Crackers and tiger tails were running thin as we reached the winding mountain roads near Rock Springs. "I need to tell you something," my dad said. "They know what the tremors are. It's ALS." And then he told different Navy stories, how veterans are at least twice as likely to get ALS, how the incidence rises for those who worked around aircraft, and how much support the VA offers. He had waited to tell me till we were getting close to home, where my mom was waiting to take off the sunglasses hiding my red, swollen eyes and wrap me in a big hug. But I wished later that we'd gone back for my pillow, so I could have had at least one more hour of stories and sandwiches and safety.
That was Phoenix writer Amanda Kerberg. You can hear more Soapbox essays at kjzz.org. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.